Hello, everybody. Today is November 5th, 2010, and just a couple of quick notes before we get started with today's show. I have been fielding a lot of questions related to t-shirts. How can I get one? When do you ship them? Well, the first question, schoolsucksproject.com. In the main nav bar, there is a store, and you can click on that, and you can order through PayPal or with a credit card. I try to ship them every Monday, so if you order one this weekend, I can have it on the way to you by Monday. So that's how that all works. And of course, thank you very much to everybody who has supported the show by buying a t-shirt and by wearing a t-shirt and maybe taking one of those stickers that came along with it and sticking it someplace where other people can see it. That's great. Also, thanks to Jason Osborne, the show's sponsor, who made all of that possible. Jason has been a very, very helpful and important, but behind-the-scenes kind of figure in the effort to spread the message of liberty to new people and to help educate others on these ideas. So he is actually in New Hampshire now, so if that's where you are, find him, approach him politely, thank him, slap him five, buy him a drink. He certainly deserves it. That being said, today's show is called A History Teacher Walks Away from Government School, Part 1 of 2. And the subtitle for this show is Preparation for Citizenship. So I'll start with an email that I received from this gentleman whose name is Rich. Hi, Brett. I have been listening to your podcast after discovering you from your guest interviews on Free Domain Radio. I have to say thank you for the great work that you've done in fighting to stop the atrocities that are being committed against children in public education. I quit my teaching job this week. Hoping to reach a few students, I thought I could get around the system somewhat and introduce philosophy, teach entrepreneurship, and self-awareness skills to students. To my dismay, it became an impossible task. The system is not just abusive to the kids, it is abusive to teachers who want to teach students about economics, philosophy, and the truth about governments. Skipping ahead just a little bit, the corruption that I saw with the school's administration made it impossible for me to work for such people. They only care about getting their hands on as much taxpayer money as possible and justify what they do with the lie that they are serving kids. What happens every day at this school is pure madness and is really sick. If you need a guest, then I have some stories to share. To which I responded, I'd like you to be the next guest on the show. And in the next two installments of School Sucks Podcast, you will hear Rich and I discuss a myriad of topics related to the government education system. That includes, as far as I'm concerned, all government-regulated and controlled collective forms of authoritarian education. Rich spent a lot of time in private school as well, as did I. We'll also speak more generally about the treatment of young people and adolescents in society today, all with the focus on the question, what are these kids being prepared for? Do their adolescent experiences give them proper preparation for the realities of the adult world that they will soon enter? The answer might surprise you, and it totally might not. I'm being joined today by Rich Nastro. Rich is a former public school teacher who left his job last week, and that's what we are going to discuss today. Rich, how are you?
I'm pretty good.
So why don't you start by telling me your story, giving us some background here. You're a relatively young guy, so it doesn't seem like you were in the system that long. Is that correct?
No, I was actually I taught in private schools for most of my teaching career. And a private school that I taught at for 13 and a half years last year closed in mid-school year because of the recession. and the school ran out of money. And then I taught at another private school for a semester. And so my first stint back into public education was just this fall. So I haven't been in public education except for 1 year when I was first teaching as a student teacher.
So you tried to get into it this year for the first time, and you were in and out pretty quick.
This was the first time I taught in a public school, correct?
Right.
And I taught in private schools, and the private school model is similar to the public school model, but at least at the private schools, the class size was smaller, and the kids were more open to learning, and I could teach in a way that I could introduce, you know, philosophy and economics and not have the principal saying, you know, how dare you say taxation is forced extraction, you know, or something like that. So I could, you know, say, where does government get its money from? I could point out that, you know, government can only get its money from taxation, inflation, or borrowing. I could actually, you know, talk about the Federal Reserve System openly, where I would never have been able to have done that in a public school.
So you had been giving that a try, I'm guessing, this year since September. Is that correct?
Right. I actually was scheduled to start in August, and then I had a car accident, and I started in October. So I was only there for 4 weeks. And the things I saw that were happening in that place, I couldn't be around it. It was just, you have to see it to really believe it. I had a tip off when I went to the training, when the training opened and they showed a video, and in the training, I don't know if you might have seen this, the video they show for teachers, public school teachers, they have a kid who's maybe 11, and he's a cute kid, and he's lecturing an audience of union teachers. And the kid's reading a script clearly written by an adult. And the kid was saying, "Do you believe in me?" And leading a chant. The teachers were all cheering, "Yes, I believe in you." And it made it seem as if all good teaching was just saying, "I believe in you." And everyone was kind of hooting and hollering. And that was kind of creepy, seeing, you know, these adults. And everyone in the room I was looking around was kind of the kid's reading a script. And then they showed the movie Precious during the training, which was a good movie. Have you seen that movie?
I haven't. I'm familiar with it, though. I know what it's about.
Okay. And the movie was supposed to be about inspiring the teachers to, because we're dealing with students who have, unfortunate family lives, like the girl in the movie. And I saw from the movie the failure of the welfare state. And looking at what happened in this girl's life, how the welfare state, you know, enabled the mom to just terrorize and abuse this child. And the system, I saw it as proof of the failure, but everyone else around me was acting like the movie showed, some of the glories of the system that, you know, I guess some people felt, maybe they felt good because they were to offer services for Precious.
Well, that's a trend too, Rich, in these films I've noticed, and I've talked about it on the show too, when they are kind of shining a spotlight on some bureaucracy that's supposed to be a service or a kind of charity, like education specifically, it's all about, you know, a real, real narrow focus on a couple of individuals who, you know, broke all the rules and overcame all the obstacles. But then it's kind of suggested that it's not a failure of the system that this one person had to hack through like the thickest woods. It's like the system is good. I mean, we learn that in education from movies like Stand and Deliver or the Michelle Pfeiffer movie, Dangerous Minds, and there's probably a handful of others. So, yeah, that's interesting. As I was going to ask you, does the movie have somewhat of a happy ending, or is there some kind of...
No, it has a tragic ending.
Yeah.
It's about a girl who is abused, and, I mean, we're talking about, I don't know if they can come up with a sadder story. She's raped by like a dad or a stepdad, catches AIDS, is impregnated by her abusive, and the mom is just disgusting character. I mean, I don't know that a movie can have a more despicable character. And I guess there's government workers who, you know, a teacher and I guess a welfare office, and maybe they feel good that they're talking to her, appearing to offer services and even help. But when you see how the movie ends, what did they really do for her in the end?
Right.
And the system, you know, when I look at this and seeing, you know, I don't know that it could have turned out worse for this girl. And how could it have turned out worse? And, but that movie was taken by the, you know, by the educators for our training as evidence to help to inspire us to want to work with these students as if we can make a difference. And, you know, I was looking around and it was shocking that I had a completely different conclusion than anybody else did. And then they showed us videos about how if there's any abuse that we're supposed to report any abuse to Child Protective Services. And then they showed us, these are hour-long videos about how we work with, I guess they call them, you know, disadvantaged families, in that we're supposed to tell them where government services are. As if these people don't already know, you know, where the welfare offices are, but we're supposed to try to steer them in the right direction of the welfare agency. And so those are some red flags. And there was a line that was used that the teachers are supposed to tell the students, I, from a first person point of view, will not let you fail. So it was, we're supposed to talk to the kids and say, I will not let you fail.
I wonder what it means to fail. I wonder, that's a very vague word. Success and failure and accomplishment and defeat are not words that are defined by students in these schools. They're defined by the authorities. So it's a nice sounding thing to say, and maybe even a little bit powerful if we don't probe into it a little bit more to see what it actually means. But that's interesting. Is there anything else that, you know, during this training?
I guess in the context that I won't let you fail means grade.
Yes,
you
exactly.
Define everything by the grade.
Exactly.
And a kid, I know from the, I mean, from my view and my experience working with kids, if I tell a student, I will not let you fail, the kid might as well hear me saying, I'm going to, you know, doctor your grade.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's, you know, that's how kids think when they hear, I won't let you fail as I see it. And so the kids are in a, we deal with kids who kind of know that grades will, I don't know, will be, you know, they'll be taken care of grade-wise. And but I wanted to really, because I spent a whole summer and I'd learned so much this summer on studying philosophy, and I had so many more insights that I didn't have before, and I thought, you know, I can introduce these ideas to kids, and there's, you know, maybe I can, because I only wish I'd learned, you know, what entrepreneurship was. I wish I'd learned that there is no such thing as a free lunch, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, these kids have this idea that wealth is something that is just automatic without understanding how and why. And so I was hoping that, you know, I could continue to spread the ideas of liberty and personal. I wanted the kids to see that they can do more for themselves than any other person could do for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, all right, I was going to give it a try. I wrote my own materials and got off to a pretty decent start. Then they, for a couple weeks in, they switched the schedule and they moved the ninth graders. It's a junior high and a middle school, and they moved the ninth graders to the middle school. And so the ninth graders who'd spent 9 weeks in the high school, we're now going to have all new teachers, and we're going to be you know, losing status because they would be with the junior high. And that was explained as it was in the best interest of the ninth graders because the workload of the middle school teachers was much lighter than the workload of the high school teachers in terms of class size.
How else would it be explained? Yeah, besides being in the best interest of the children. And they also, you know, the interesting thing, too, is you said they lose status, but I would guess that going from being the youngest and the smallest kids in one setting to the oldest and the biggest kids in another setting, in another way, they kind of gain status, and maybe they go into the middle school looking to no, it's not. I hate to say they, like all of them, but some of them maybe go into the middle school looking to flex a little bit of muscle, especially if they were getting.
But then that's exactly what happened, and they used the logic that the ninth graders were being negatively influenced by the 12th graders, that's a point. I guess, you know, seniors can, you know, have a corrupting influence on younger ninth graders, but then that same logic, the ninth graders can have a, you know, can influence seventh graders.
Yeah, absolutely.
But those ninth graders came up and, there's a lot of angry kids with the change. They did dominate the halls, and there was more fighting going on in the halls, and the ninth graders were able to set a new tone, and the culture was dictated by the ninth graders. But on a day-out basis, there was, you know, screaming in the hallways and door slamming, and you're trying to teach, and it's, you know, the kids are, that's impossible to teach with that kind of distractions right outside. And you could hear, you know, teachers yelling at students, and it became became this repetitive process where there's just kids in the acting out. And I used the philosophy approach where I would talk to the kid, you know, why did you say that to that person, or, you know, why are you doing that? And then the kids would give me their answers, but it reached a level where the kids who got the most attention were the kids who were acting out the most, and pretty soon, you know, the better behaved kids were, in order to get attention, were trying to do something because, you know, these kids want a connection with an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way they could have, you know, a discussion about their behavior was to do something disruptive.
Yeah, I think we could tell very, very similar stories because my background is, you know, much like yours. I started in private school. I worked with at-risk teenagers. The squeaky wheels always got the grease, and, you know, the wheels that didn't squeak had to get a little bit louder to get some of the attention and support that they needed and, you know, they felt like they deserved.
And it became a moral issue where there were kids who I wanted to, there were some kids who were interested in the, you know, the fundamentals of market economies, were learning, but by the time the schedule changed, it was basically me putting out one, you know, dealing with behavior. And these kids have, you know, difficult family lives, and, you know, the family situation, you know, broken homes, drug use. They've seen things that children abuse. The children, you can see the abuse in that, you know, they can't maintain any eye contact, and they have, you know, they look at it as a power struggle where, you know, if they can act out in class and it just, then they have some sense of power and control.
Right. What they lack so much in their own lives, be it, you know, their abusive homes or the school environments or their social environments. One of the things that I've always said is, you know, closer to the roots of this bullying problem that they're trying to deal with now in schools through just more crackdowns and more force is the, I think in many ways, a desire to feel some sense of control. And I'm guessing you're saying you saw the same thing.
I saw, there was one kid who on a day in, day out basis would use the language like, and make, you know, he would make obscene gestures and he would drop F-bombs in class. And it was, you know, he would get, you know, sent out, or, but he'd always be back in there. And it was like, and even talking to him, you know, this was his, I mean, it felt like there was a power struggle where I was, you know, imposing the structure of the classroom, and he was going to make sure his will was going to override that because he's so powerless in other areas of his life. And I just, the way the school dealt with things, like, I can just give an example early on where there was a girl who had written, I had a notebook, and where they were supposed to do a bunch of work, and she had written all these I love this other kid, and she'd written it like over 100 times.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all over the notebook. And I saw that. And I wanted, my concern was how she viewed herself. You know, that basically we can only make our, I mean, these other people so big by making ourselves so small.
Mm-hmm.
And there happened to be a parent-teacher conference, which I hadn't scheduled with this girl that day. And when I, asked her about what was going on with all that, the child wasn't given a chance to answer the question. The adults took over and started basically scolding her for using time to write all this. And then another person went in there on a long speech about how all the boys here are losers. You don't want any of the boys here. But it was no, I mean, the real issue about, you know, this girl's, how she sees herself was never touched on.
Right.
In that. But we, as you're saying, the kids, I mean, these kids, unlike other kids at this school, you know, when I was in school and probably when you were in school, teachers could, you know, threaten us with the lie that your future depends on your grades in high school. You know, you need to get into a good college, and if you don't get into a good college, then, you know, you won't have any, you know, any hopes of a decent life. At this school, these kids have figured out already, you know, in a collapsing economy, that education is not their ticket to a better life. They know something's wrong. They don't know exactly what, but you can't, as a teacher, hold over them, you know, what was held over me as a student to kind of control me was the threat of, you know, do well in high school so you can go to college, and go to college, you can have, you know, a good high-paying job, and you won't have any opportunities if you don't.
Yeah, you know, that's another issue that I've noticed when I was working with at-risk teenagers who mostly lived in the inner city, is they are already kind of seeing, in many cases, you know, through the what they're exposed to in their neighborhoods, in housing projects, with drug dealers and gangs, they already see another path to what they think is wealth. And there's people, I think, that are influencing them that are making that path look easy, or that it leads someplace besides, you know, the grave or a jail cell. And here I was, you know, this upper middle class white kid talking to all of these boys from Washington, D.C. and Providence, Rhode Island and, you know, Queens and Brooklyn, telling them about the importance of grades, because that's, I mean, this, you know, was 7-8 years ago, but that was pounded into my head so deeply for so long that I just found myself repeating it to them. They know it's false, and I'm not even really, at the time, I wasn't even really thinking about what I was saying, that I knew grades didn't matter because I was a terrible student, and here I was their teacher like 6 years later. So it's amazing how, yeah, ingrained that gets, huh?
It did, and I was in exact same situation you were in. I was, you know, telling the kids that grades are important, that grades, you know, that your future can be, you can improve your future by getting better grades. And these kids, you know, where I was, you know, I bought the lie when I was in high school. These kids have seen through that. They already know that it doesn't, the grades really aren't going to affect anything, and they're right now, they're short-term thinkers anyway. You know, when the life they have is about survival from one day to the next.
Right.
So they can't really, at a school like this, process, all right, I can maybe get scholarship money down the road if I, you know, can maintain a valedictorian GPA. But I found myself, yeah, in that situation where I'm talking about grades and how students need to, you know, fall in the line, when I knew that, you know, I'm not really practicing. You know, I am another person whose grades weren't all that great. And basically my knowledge that I got was self-educated. I learned all the wrong things in college. I mean, I had professors teaching me about, you know, spending is government spending creates prosperity. You know, I had professors teaching me that World War II ended the Great Depression, as if, you know, the death of 60 million people is a good thing.
Yeah.
I had, you know, professors teaching me that the United States is a free market, yet there's Medicare, you know, government intervention in the central bank, and that government intervention and government taxation is a solution to every problem. And I started out teaching those same false concepts, but through the internet, I was able to, I was introduced to Austrian economics and was able to really see that, you know, so much of what I had been learned was simply not true.
And I think, you know, just to combine the last two things you've said about, you know, telling these kids what's important for their future and being able to provide some real economics education to them. If you think about most of the people, like I graduated from high school in 1995, so most of the people who were being told these stories when they were in school, who are working as teachers in the public school today, were probably either educated in the 80s or the 90s. So the 80s, we have this just like decade-long Coke binge, savings and loans, everybody's rich. The 90s, we see this tech boom happening in the latter half of the decade. But now it's really important that they understand the times have changed, and I really hope that teachers, the people who are trying to say, oh, well, you know, it's really important that you get the, you know, the highest of these five options of letters that can evaluate your intellectual abilities, because that will present these options for you in the future. The best thing that you can say about the government school system is that it prepares you to be a somewhat reliable and certainly compliant employee for somebody else. And now, you know, the reality is that there just might not be jobs. The world doesn't really need droves of employees pouring out of these schools anymore. So I think it's a real shame that I was doing it certainly when I was teaching, and that people are still doing it today. It's all about this focus on performance review. How will somebody else evaluate your strengths and weaknesses and your skills? And that's like the wrong message. That is for this time, that is very, very dangerous, because it's preparing them, I think, ultimately to fail in an economy where there might not be too many jobs.
No, exactly right. And I don't know that the teachers have really grasped the new economic realities, because they're...
Why would they? Yeah,
there are
yeah.
still, you know, teachers selling kids on, you know, going to college and incurring crippling debt to get degrees. Like, you know, there's like one example, and, you know, we have record numbers of people going to law school, I think, and more law students, you know, taking the loans and incurring the debt. And, you know, even though the reality is that the jobs as lawyers, they can't find jobs. And people are still continuing to go to law school thinking that, you know, it used to be you go to law school, you're going to have a very high-paying, lucrative career. And now, I have some former students from my other school who graduated law school, and, you know, they're working at Target.
Right.
So the idea that you can just go to school, these jobs that used to be there, even a lot of those finance jobs in Wall Street are going to be, you know, are going to go away, because there's, you know, we can't, the nation as a whole can't afford to pay people these salaries for producing absolutely nothing.
Mm. And it's such a setup too, when we think about the people who are giving some basic education to these young people in the field of economics right now. They live in economic fantasy land, pretty much. And, you know, I tried to record this school news episode maybe like a month ago about Obama putting forward or passing, basically this passed, this bailout for teachers. It was like $23 to $25 billion to back up their pension plans. Now, how is that going to affect their already subjective presentation of pretty Keynesian economics in these schools when they realize that they also have this safety net that the government will create for them. And I honestly scratched the episode. I recorded 15 minutes of it. I was so angry. I felt like I was going to bounce my computer down the stairs if I kept going. Maybe I'll get back to that eventually, but it was just so frustrating. Of course, a system that supports the government like education could only ever be funded this way. Because if you think about the ways that society has been pushed forward in the past, it was through the arts, it was through the sciences, and it was through education. And in the last century, we have seen the government hand out plenty of money to all three, the arts, the sciences, and education. Kind of strings attached that turn out to be chains, or maybe even more appropriately, leashes, to make sure that nothing revolutionary is going to happen in any of those fields. So that's, I want to just point that out. I want to make sure we really hit on that for students who are listening to this show. The economics education you are getting in school is so just destructive and slanted. That's really important.
And the high salaries of a lot of those, you know, white collar, unproductive kind of jobs, like, you know, was made only possible in the government bureaucracy growth, made only possible by the government deficit, you know, deficit spending and central bank inflation. So once you reach a point where the debt is where it's at now, and the dollar is, you know, reaching, you know, gold's reaching all-time highs and dollars, you know, hitting lows, the game of financing it is not, I mean, how much longer can it go on? And a lot of people think, well, it was, you know, the money was rolling. And there are people who actually think that home prices are just ready to just jump up again to the boom, without realizing that the economy was distorted by monetary policy. And so the jobs that really create value, I mean, the job where you're actually offering a service that's valuable, that, and there were jobs that were high paying, they were only made possible because of a, you know, central bank and a government running up borrowing money. So in the new economy, though, you know, people are going to have to offer goods and services that provide value at a price that people want to pay if there's going to be any real recovery. But a teacher is somebody who can't, I mean, it's kind of hypocritical for a teacher to be teaching entrepreneurship when,
oh, exactly, yeah, yeah.
You know, when your salary is being paid by tax dollars, and
so that was. I'll go ahead and finish up because then I did have a follow-up question.
I made that. I would see. I mean, I probably wouldn't have lasted long. I talked about universal preferential behavior and that there were UPB violations in the classroom and that, you know, I can give them homework, they can't give me homework, you know, I can, you know, do this, they can't do that. But I wanted to minimize it by, you know, I'm not gonna, you know, yell at anybody, nobody can yell. So, but I admitted that there was not an entrepreneur that I was getting paid out of tax dollars. And I tried, when I first asked the kids, I put the question, how could you be an entrepreneur? The students had no idea how they could be an entrepreneur. And it was a completely foreign concept to them. And
Can you just define, I know UPB, universally preferable behavior, is Stefan Molyneux. Just for anyone who isn't familiar, how would you
sum that up? It was basically a moral principle that if that applies throughout all time and all situations. And basically, and I wanted them to see what they could find for themselves as a moral principle. And that, and I used examples, you know, like, because this group was inner city and distrusted police, for example. And I said, everybody can come up with their own. My mom disagrees, because my mom, you know, believes that if she was in danger, she would call the police. But for me, a UPB that I learned on my own through studying history was, and I preface this, you know, do your verify and check. But for me, a police officer can only give me a ticket or arrest me. And I told a story when I got, you know, a ticket from a motorcycle cop for not having a seatbelt. And you know, I asked the cop where his seatbelt was, and the cop, you know, was saying, you know, you can't ask the questions, only I can ask the questions. I was trying to point out to the kids, then, you know, if there's a rule that only applies to, you know, where it's, where it applies for one group and not to another, then may, you know, consider that maybe you're being, you know, bullied and manipulated, and that you shouldn't automatically accept that.
And I always say silly sounding things on the show, and sometimes in my conversations with people, like blue costume, green costume, has a badge on, calls himself this, that really is kind of maybe a little bit reductive, like, oh, well, that person can, the blue costume gives them magical powers, sarcastically. But this is really, I mean, this goes back to the education itself, that these costumes and job titles and, you know, illusions of authority and all of this moral relativism only exists because people are being trained to be so obedient to authority and to conform with so few questions.
And that's exactly right. And I mean, a person who can't think for themselves, that's a person who can be brainwashed. You know, if you're an independent thinker, it doesn't matter who comes around. I would, you know, in the class, I introduced, you know, just because I am, you know, in the position of an authority figure doesn't mean I'm right. If an authority figure is right, then, you know, if I'm telling you tie that kid up, then you should do it because I'm right. If I say, you know, everyone jump off a building, we should do it. And we have to be able to think for ourselves because nobody can, just as nobody can be better at dressing ourselves than we can, nobody can be better at thinking for ourselves than we can. And everybody else, even if they care and love you, it's always going to be their own wants are going to factor in. And we don't all have the same wants and desires. And so I wanted to, you know, open the kids' eyes that it's okay that they have wants and desires. They're not bad wants and desires. And they have to understand that if obedience is virtue, then we can justify, you know, what the Nazis did. You know, they were following orders.
Right.
You can justify any evil. So what makes the argument isn't who's making it. It's whether or not it could stand up to questioning and whether or not it's true or it's right. And then the kids, I think that concept did interest them. But one difficulty with these students is when you can't read or write, or when you read or write at such a low level and you've reached, you know, ninth or eighth grade, you kind of, in your mind, you have a total aversion to reading. And you really can't think if you can't read.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree. Language is obviously, language is the basis of thought. But, yeah, you're right, because you really are just living in this very small and isolated world of the simple thoughts that you can form without that outside stimulus. Yeah,
and so you have to not only read what you're writing, but you have to be able to question it and say, all right, you know, how did they know that? What's the evidence? What is history? What happened in the past? And is that true? Well, and a lot of kids just want, you know, they don't have confidence in their own ability to figure out the truth. So, and, you know, as adults, it gives adults a lot of power to be able to just tell kids, this is how it is. And how many adults like it when they start getting questioned? If a kid were to ask, for example, why is the sky blue? You know, adults don't like answering that question because it's going to, you know, they might make up some reasons and the kid's going to will not be satisfied. And it'll come out that the adult really doesn't know, as if that's a crime.
Yeah, and I think information illiteracy blocks a lot of these realizations. I mean, I know plenty of kids who are in, you know, college track, the kids that I've worked with in the past year in these SAT classes, and it's not true across the board, but even kids who can read can't read. Like, even kids who can look at graphemes and turn them into phonemes and then turn those into words and make the words into sentences and ultimately into a paragraph, They don't understand a lot of times the tone, the point of view. They don't question what they're reading. They often will repeat things verbatim without even thinking about the intentions. So literacy is obviously more complicated than just stringing a bunch of phonemes together. It is exactly what you were saying, the ability to think independently, critically. And that's something that even in high school, where the kids are not at risk, they're not special ed, that skill set is not being delivered by the schools. But I would never expect it to be. I mean, I really think that that's something people have to learn and cultivate on their own.
Right. I thought a lot about why that is, that kids have, they really want to be told what to think and rather than think for themselves. And part of it is it's easier. But I was thinking also that when a kid does exercise independent thought, what happens when he challenges, let's say we have a, emotionally abusive parent, and the kid challenges, that, what happens? Whose will went out? And so eventually the kid, when he does question and challenge, will find himself getting attacked. And in order to survive, the kid, how many, 9, 10, 11-year-olds can go out and rent their own apartments and make it on their own? So you got to do what you have to do to survive, which means just, go along. And the more abusive the parents are in a lot of these situations, the harder it is for those kids to develop critical thinking skills, because then they'll realize that, they are in such a threatening, the conscious mind may not be able to handle the reality that they are really, really in such a dangerous situation.
Yeah, and there's no respite at school.
Right, and there's no, in school, and if a kid does act out in class, and then you call the parents, kid gets all the blame. The kid, I've seen where the kid blames, but you can't question the parent about why he's so angry. Why is this kid so angry? You can't point out, and I've seen parents just yell at their kids thinking that that's what the school wants them to do.
And I used to work, like I said, at this private school with at-risk kids, and when we would have meetings where sometimes if they even had parents and they would, they would come up and maybe once in a very great while be involved in these meetings, when the focus is more on the family, boy, that never went well. That was never very, very comfortable.
It can't, because you can't. It's a lot easier to, the kid's powerless, so it's a lot easier to just attack the kid for being unmotivated and, not liking, school, and then the parent it looks like the parent, when they do show up, by supporting the school in the sense that, they're going to yell at the kid for not doing his homework, they're going to yell at the kid for misbehaving in class. The parent feels like they're being a good parent by doing that.
Yeah, all the adults, the parents and school folks who are really most responsible for the problem can kind of team up and put up this smokescreen of authority that diverts attention away from the real problems.
Right. And if yelling at the kid worked, it's not like we haven't, there haven't been enough adults who've, yelled at and scolded at this kid.
So we'll break right there for now. And I will put out the second part of this discussion within the next couple of days. But before we completely wrap this show up, I want to make sure that we address the question that I asked at the beginning of the show. What are these kids being prepared for in these schools through their adolescent experiences? And, of course, at home. Well, people often seem very concerned with this citizenship thing. They want kids to be prepared to be good citizens. Well, even though school might be creating this picture of a complete economic fantasy world while totally blinding kids to the realities that they might face as future employees, as adults trying to make their way in the world, I assure you, the citizenship part is definitely being taken care of, both in the school and in the home. as Rich said just a couple of minutes ago.
You got to do what you have to do to survive, which means just, you know, go along. And the more abusive the parents are in a lot of these situations, the harder it is for those kids to develop critical thinking skills, because then they'll realize that, you know, they are in a, I mean, such a threatening, I mean, the conscious mind may not be able to handle the reality that they are really, really in such a dangerous situation.
And if you are the kind of person who uses the word citizen with pride, and you take offense to that subtle comparison, I guess you could argue that the adult citizen does have one distinct advantage over the abused child. Because after all, the abused child does not get to take part in a biennial or quadrennial ceremony where they can pretend to be in charge of selecting who their abusers will be. Because if children could pick the people who abuse them, as long as they always made sure to pick somebody to do it, wouldn't that just change everything? Thanks for listening, and take care.